Evil lives and grows in women just as much as men. Grows to the point where they murder. Murder again, again, and again. Jolly Jane. The Death Nurse. The Mulatto Axe Murderer. The Lonely Hearts Killers. Shopping Slayer. The Grandma Serial Killer. The Sunset Strip Killers. The Giggling Grandma. These are just a few of the nicknames for some of the most monstrous female serial killers.
The true crime audience is primarily female. Love to hear about them, but more because they know that they are vulnerable to being targeted. When they watch these stories and watch the way the killer was caught.
There's some evidence that women in particular are fascinated by these kinds of crimes, afraid when they read these headlines and they hear the 6 o'clock news. And that makes some sense to me. First of all, women are often victims of these crimes. It makes sense to me that women would feel particularly vulnerable, male perpetrator, female victim. And I think there's this almost instinctive fear on the part of women that they could be victimized. But in this culture, perhaps in many cultures, women may feel more vulnerable with good reason. They are sometimes easier targets.
Yes, women love true crime stories about serial killers, but are they deadly serial killers themselves?
When we're talking about serial killers, we must never forget that there are female serial killers. Maybe 15, 16% of serial killers today are female. And we don't talk about them so much because they don't kill the same way as men. In fact, Eileen Wuornos was considered to be the first female serial killer, which is not true. There have been many serial killers who were female prior to her. But because she shot her victims with a gun, she acted more like a male, and so they consider her to be a female serial killer. But in truth, there have been many, and they don't get caught. They can go on longer than men. And we don't think of them as being as dangerous, and yet they are just as dangerous as men. I mean, if you're dead, it doesn't really matter how you died, right? Whether you get poisoned, or you get hacked to death, you're still dead. And the fact that if a woman can kill 10 people, and a man kills 10 people, why should we just be just as concerned about the female?
So why do women kill? What drives them to murder again and again? Why are their stories less known when their body count can be just as high as any man? Is it because we think of them as the gentler sex? In reality, women kill for many reasons, just like men.
Women tend to be viewed as gentler killers if they do kill, primarily because they might use poison or something like that. But the victims are just as dead as everybody else, and sometimes they are torturers. Females tend to get names like Angel of Death or, you know, Jolly Jane or something that does not connote their lethality. And I think that's unfortunate. I think some female serial killers are, you know, very aggressive and predatory.
Ironically, there are more female serial killers than most people think. They frequently team up with a male serial killer. They're not always on their own. The black widows that we refer to are serial killers because they're killing their husbands for insurance and they go on to another husband. That I would consider a serial killer. The angels of death, if you will, the term that's generally used for healthcare workers in a hospital, these people are caring for generally the elderly, generally very sick, and they claim afterwards, when they're caught, that they're simply putting people out of their misery. In other words, they feel sorry. But in most cases, that's not true. It's a power game with them, the way in which they put these people out, putting cyanide in their tube and watching them. You know, people sitting there that are basically paralyzed because of their disease, and putting cyanide in a feeding tube or an IV and watching them die. And of course, the victim there is knowingly dying at that time.
Historical records show that female serial killers go back a long way.
When we go all the way back to ancient Rome, we begin with, for the first documented serial killer is a female. So females are definitely represented among serial killers, not only as individuals, but also on teams, because we do have team serial killers as well.
Reviled as the Blood Countess, Elizabeth Bathory was a Hungarian noblewoman whose serial murdering spanned two centuries, from the late 1500s to her death in 1614. Guinness World Records has labeled her the most prolific female murderer of all time, reportedly mutilating and killing up to 650 young girls. However, there was a golden age of female serial killers in the U.S. and Europe. Female serial killers who targeted their children, husbands, and other family members. This was a time when women were becoming educated but had very little control over their lives. As a result, they had very few recourses or legal remedies if they found themselves in a bad marriage or untenable domestic situations. A solution was to free themselves by poisoning their husbands or anyone controlling their lives and even killing their children. One of those Victorian women was Jolly Jane Toppin. At the same time as H.H. Holmes was murdering for profit and Jack the Ripper was preying on prostitutes, Jane Toppin, who became one of America's most prolific female serial killers, a killer who killed just to see the life drain out of her victims' eyes. When finally caught in 1901, appalled detectives and doctors were terrified by their own conclusion. Jane Toppin was the proverbial bad seed, descended from a lineage of evil, handed down from father to son, mother to daughter. Killers who, in the 19th century's way of understanding, were born bad, born with the seed of evil in them.
The concept of the bad seed, the concept of the serial killer having these kind of inborn instincts that compels them to kill, I think is largely myth. I'm willing to believe that there are people who, at the time of birth, may have a predisposition toward mental illness that may ultimately compel them to kill. You know, there are a number of serial killers who have been diagnosed with schizophrenia. Well, schizophrenia often has biochemical genetic roots that ultimately can manifest themselves in serial killing. But I'm reluctant to use language such as bad seed. I think that is too simplistic and doesn't recognize that often what we're dealing with here is very complex psychiatric disturbance and mental illness.
The theme of inherited evil would be brought into the spotlight in the spellbinding 1956 movie, The Bad Seed, based on Toppin herself. Like Rhoda, the young girl from the movie, Jane Toppin had inherited evil. Her father went insane and so did an older sister. But unlike Rhoda, Jane's murderous ways did not come to full flower until she entered nursing school in 1885. It was here she learned the skills to become an angel of death as she moved effortlessly among the middle and upper classes as a private nurse. Skills she would use to poison 31 people with lethal injections of morphine and atropine, two chemicals that offset the symptoms of each other.
There are a number of cases throughout history when serial killers inject people with drugs and kill them, this kind of silent killing. You don't hear gunshots. You don't hear the sounds of strangulation. You don't hear the sounds of stabbings.
Most serial killers are men. And the few serial killers who are women are not sexual sadists for the most part. There are, however, some women who are medical practitioners, nurses, nurses' aides, who decide to play God with the lives of their patients. They decide who lives and who dies, and it makes them feel powerful. They may not use sex as a vehicle for gaining a sense of control and dominance, but they do it by injecting a lethal dose of morphine, as Topin did, or suffocating their patients with a pillow. It makes them feel so good. It makes them feel powerful and superior to their poor victims. And by taking their lives of their patients, they feel godly. And that's why they do it.
And when you interview the offender, you get this kind of cool, calm demeanor, suggesting that this individual isn't upset by the killings. And of course, that's deeply disturbing to talk to someone who doesn't seem to be rattled by these remarkably heinous murders. And in my experience, in those cases, often what you're dealing with is somebody who manifests psychopathic qualities, somebody who, as is often the case, has a trauma history, someone who has a history of abuse, someone who is so intensely angry, someone who is rageful toward the world, toward individual people, and will often manifest their rage in killing others and destroying lives.
Born Honora Kelly in 1857, Jane was adopted at age 5 by a Boston family, the Topins, after her father went insane. Later, one of Jane's sisters was also committed for insanity. Unlike most serial killers, Jane was a bright, cheerful child who learned quickly. At 19, she became betrothed, but was jilted at the altar by her fiancé. Strangely uncommunicative and even hostile after that, Jane left home to study nursing. Once more, she excelled in her studies, though supervisors were concerned about her fascination with autopsies. It was also during this time that her personality changed radically, becoming like two different people. Known as Jolly Jane to her bosses and clients, she was a teetotaler and jovial, often telling outrageous and amusing stories. But at night, she caroused in bars, drank beer, and denounced everyone at work. Jane passed her nursing exams in 1887, and for the next 14 years, she plied her trade of killing while pretending to be an angel of mercy. She was finally brought to justice in 1901 after she killed off the entire Davis family of Catamount, Massachusetts. After her trial, Jane described how she felt unattached to any of her victims. Yet, clearly, she was sexually aroused by the killing. Topin even once described climbing into bed with one of her female victims, caressing and fondling her as she died. and watched with delight as she gasped her life out. Topan was found not guilty by reason of insanity and spent the rest of her life in a mental hospital. She would taunt the hospital staff, "Get some morphine, dearie, and we'll go out in the ward." She would add with a chilling smile, "You and I will have a lot of fun seeing them die." She died in 1938, the bad seed to the end. The irony of H.H. Holmes and Jane Topin is that they killed hundreds more than Jack the Ripper. Yet, they never terrorized the cities where they lived. In fact, they went out of their way to make certain that their killings never caused headlines. Newspapers blaring front-page stories of cold-blooded murderers loose on big city streets would have been bad for the business of murder. And for both Holmes and Topin, killing people was a business like any other. Another American Victorian serial killer was a brutal 6-foot Norwegian immigrant. Just as H.H. Holmes pulled the trigger on the emergence of the American male serial killer, so did Bell Gunness do the same for the American female serial killer. She combined profit with serial killing, enjoying both to the fullest. Born in Norway in 1859, Bell Gunness immigrated to the U.S. in 1881. By the turn of the century, her killing farm in LaPorte, Indiana, was ready to welcome a multitude of murder victims.
Bell Gunness was clearly a predatory female from the get-go. She was a Norwegian-American who married, had kids, and routinely killed them to get insurance money. She had a husband. They probably burned down their businesses and collected the insurance together, and then he died of a heart attack on, coincidentally, the very day when two insurance policies overlapped by one day, so she was able to collect on both. So that seems very odd. She had several children who disappeared. She collected on them. Bell had a second husband who died within 8 months from supposedly boiling water and a meat grinder falling on his head, even though there were no burn marks and the wound didn't match the meat grinder. So she collected on that, bought herself a pig farm. Then she proceeded to place Lonely Hearts ads into the newspapers, looking for men of means who wanted to help a lonely woman on a pig farm who needed assistance, even though this woman was almost 6 feet tall and very healthy and able to do this herself. She would tell them things like, as these correspondences developed, she would tell them things like, don't tell anyone where you're going. Take all the money you have out of your bank accounts, sew it into your coat, and then come and be with me, and we will have, amazing pleasure and wonderful love, and you'll help me at my pig farm. And those men generally disappeared. Why anyone would think that was a good thing for them to do is tell nobody. But one of them actually did tell somebody, and that brother came looking for him. And at that point, Bell's farmhouse burned down. And supposedly it burned down with her in it and three of her kids, or she staged her own death and got away, and that has not been definitively determined. What we definitely know is that Bell Gunness was a predator, and her motive was profit, self-gain.
Her murder spree earned her the nicknames of Hell's Bell, the Black Widow, and Lady Bluebeard. Bell's murderous career set the stage for women to serial kill for lust, profit, and power over other humans. Kate Bender, another of these early female serial killers, was part of a family team of murderers. They were Pa, Ma, John Jr., and Kate, an American family that earned the nickname the Bloody Benders. In October 1870, five families of German spiritualists settled in western Kansas along the Osage Trail. One of them was the John Bender family, who claimed 160 acres. Pa Bender was described as illiterate and spoke very little English. Ma Bender was born Almira Hill in the Adirondack Mountains. By the time she moved to Kansas, she was believed to have murdered several of her husbands. Kate, the beautiful throat cutter Bender, was believed to be Ma's fifth daughter. In 1871, a year after arriving in Kansas, the serial killing began. The family had built a one-room home, equipped with a canvas curtain that divided the space into two areas. The front was a public inn and store, and the family quarters were in the back. Travelers on the trail were welcome to refresh themselves with a meal and resupply their wagons.
There have been numerous TV shows and movies about inns where people checked in and don't check out. And this was maybe the archetypal one, the beginning one. In 1871 in Kansas, the Bender family had a little plot of land where they put up a two-room building. One room was their living quarters, the other was the inn. But it wasn't a typical inn because they just killed people. It was a family affair. Pa Bender and John Jr. Bender would keep watch. They would do surveillance over the environment and the flat plains, so it was easy to see folks coming from a long way away. And then when somebody was spotted, they sent Kate out to attract them because most travelers were men and Kate was rather comely. So Kate would go out and lure the men into the house. At that point, Ma took over, Ma Bender, and cooked meals, asked what they would like, and kind of mothered them a little bit. Then, when the meal began, Kate would distract the men in typical ways that women can distract men. And then Pa Bender and John Jr. were behind a curtain that separated the building. And then they were hit with a sledgehammer from behind and then had their throat slit. And there was a trap door in the back part of the house. So the men were killed, their clothes were taken, their items were taken, the bodies were dumped down inside the trap door.
The Benders' luck ran out in March 1873 after a well-known physician from Independence, Kansas, named Dr. William York, seemingly disappeared after getting off a nearby train. Dr. York had two powerful brothers who were determined to find out what happened to him. The locals decided to search all the residences, and when they came to the Benders' place, it was empty, and the Bloody Bender family was gone. What they found were bodies under the trap door. One local source alleged 8 bodies were located, while another study discovered 10 victims. Estimates of the number of victims ranged as high as 21. Whatever the number, the discovery was a sensation. Soon after, the original death hotel, the Bender Hotel, was wiped from the face of the earth by local residents. As for the Bloody Benders, they disappeared into the winds of time. Early in her life, Ma Bender would be called a black widow, a woman who kills her husband. But her daughter, Kate, was a transitional figure to the modern female serial killer.
For women serial killers, the modus operandi has changed over time. Originally, it was poisoning almost exclusively. But now, like the Dana Sue Gray case, women kill in all kind of ways. They shoot people. They stab people occasionally. Eileen Wuornos was a very violent serial killer. So originally, poisoning was the main MO of female serial killers, and it's kind of transformed to a broader range of ways to kill.
Another woman who used her farm to entice her male victims was Sheila, the avenging angel Labar. This female monster was born Sheila K. Bailey on July 4th, 1958, in Fort Payne, Alabama. She regularly enticed younger men to her New Hampshire farm, where she would torture and control them. In 2008, LaBarre became one of the state's most notorious murderers. Like her male serial-killing counterparts, she was a psychopathic predator. An investigator described her this way. She is from the South and could turn on a Southern accent and charm so she could be very charming, but also very intelligent and very terrifying. She used this charm to lure men onto her farm.
Sheila LaBarre is kind of an interesting serial killer. We only know of two confirmed murders, but when the police searched her place, they found three toes, which did not belong to either of the two gentlemen who were killed. So we can include her in the traditional definition of serial killers being three or more victims. She supposedly lured men to her home, sometimes autistic, sometimes special needs people, sometimes homeless, and then lured them with typical things that men are lured with, and then tortured them and killed them.
LaBarre was sentenced to two consecutive life sentences, with no prospect of parole after being convicted of killing two men, Kenneth County and Michael DeLoge. She may have been a black widow as well, killing two of her former husbands. At her trial, LaBarre claimed she was an angel sent by God to punish pedophiles. This former beauty queen accused the two men she killed of being pedophiles, which they certainly weren't. Betty Lou Beetz never had trouble attracting men. In 1952, at the age of 15, she married her first husband. She would marry five more times, transforming into the classic black widow serial murderer. Women who kill their husbands, one after another, for various reasons. Born in North Carolina in 1937, Betty Lou had a difficult early family life. Her alcoholic father beat her, and her mother suffered from a nervous breakdown when she was 12. Betty Lou married early to escape her troubled family life, only to find that her new husband was an abusive drunk who beat her. 17 years later, she divorced the man and remarried 1 year later. That's when Betty Lou's life changed.
Betty Beetz was an interesting lady. When she was 5 years old, she got mumps, and it appeared to cause deafness and neurological problems, because some folks said that she talked like a child and thought like a child. An interesting thing, there's a pharmacological connection here. She was considered a great mom and a great person, and she began to take Dexedrine because of her weight. And after that, her children say she changed entirely and went from being a very pleasant, nice woman to being a verbal and very mean person. So in this case, she may not have handled the Dexedrine well or taken more than she was supposed to. She killed two husbands that we know of, maybe a third, and her M.O. was the same, the M.O. She would shoot them in their sleep and then take them outside and bury them. And she was a serial killer for profit, which is a rather common thing. And in her case, she went after her husband's pensions and life insurance money and savings accounts and their entire estate. And that's how she was caught. She was convicted of forgery first. The police weren't really looking at her as a killer. They thought she was just a forger. And then the forgery conviction led to a further, bigger investigation, and she was charged with capital murder for remuneration, or the promise of remuneration.
This black widow murdered two of her husbands, Jimmy Don Beetz and Doyle Barker, and attempted to murder two others. Betty Lou's M.O. was the same. Shot her husbands at close range while they slept. In 1985, she was tried and convicted of killing Jimmy Don Beetz. She was executed by lethal injection at 6:18 p.m. Central Standard Time on February 24, 2000, in Texas. At the time of the execution, she was 62 years old, and except for serial killing, she was pretty normal. Betty Lou had five children, 9 grandchildren, and 6 great-grandchildren. A black widow of the worst kind was Nanny Doss. Born in 1905 and a daughter of the Confederacy, Nanny Doss, on the outside, was a friendly and happy neighbor, wife, and parent. On the inside lurked a cold-blooded murderess who nearly wiped out her entire family single-handedly. Her first victims, her own children. Her first husband, George Frazier, arrived home one day in 1920 and found the kids lying on the kitchen floor, dead. Doss claimed it had been an accidental poisoning. Not convinced and fearing for his life, Frazier left and never went back. Doss pocketed a small amount of insurance money for the deaths of her children. The early 1950s were a lethal time for anyone closely associated with Doss. Relatives and husbands of Doss continued to die of stomach problems and other such supposed ailments until Doss's fifth husband, Samuel Doss, suddenly passed away. The doctor in the case was not as gullible as the previous ones and did not take Doss at her word. He ordered an autopsy to be done, which revealed massive doses of arsenic in the man's system. The bodies of Doss's husbands, relatives, and children were exhumed and tested. It was found that Doss's two infant children, four of her husbands, two of her sisters, her mother, and a nephew had all been killed by arsenic poisoning. Armed with this information, police soon convinced Doss to confess, and she was sent to prison for life in 1964. Known for laughing on her way to incarceration, the giggling grandma succumbed to leukemia the following year. Another early serial killer case coming out of the Deep South was a vicious African-American axe-murdering female. For a long time, serial killer experts believed that serial murder was largely a crime of white males, gay or straight. Of course, it is now known that serial murder knows no gender or ethnic boundaries. Blacks and Hispanics, women, gay or straight, are just as likely to become serial killers as their white male counterparts. The title of the first black American female serial killer goes to Clementine Barnabet, also known as the mulatto axe murderer. Ironically, Louisiana would soon have another axe murderer case, the infamous Axeman of New Orleans. Clementine's case has been referred to as the mulatto axe murders because her victims were murdered by axe and were members of families with mixed-race children. Mulatto is an early historical term used at the time to describe people of mixed race. The killer was presumed, by blacks and the police alike, to be selecting victims on the basis of their mixed or tainted blood. This case is also often referred to as the voodoo murders because of the alleged religious voodoo motive. The murders began in 1909. The local newspaper called them the most brutal murder in the history of the region. But it was just one of the axe slayings that would terrify parts of Louisiana and Texas in the early 1910s. Clementine's killings came to an end when the Daily Picayune reported on November 28, 1911, there was a complete suit of woman's clothes in Clementine's room, saturated with blood and covered with human brains. At the time of her arrest, rumors were swirling that Clementine was the leader of some kind of voodoo cult called the Church of Sacrifice. On April 5, 1912, Clementine made a full confession, admitting to 17 murders. But with most black serial killer crimes, the murders received little newspaper coverage, and as the years have gone by, few people remember this case. Her defense attorneys claimed she was insane, but she stood trial and was found guilty of multiple murders, and she was sentenced to life at a Louisiana penitentiary at the age of 19. However, in August of 1923, Clementine Barnabette walked out of prison and was never seen or heard from again. Throughout history, women have often teamed up with another woman, or more frequently, with a man, to form powerful killing buddies. They are buddy serial killers.
When people think of serial killers, they think of loners. Well, nothing could be farther from the truth there. Lots of them have relationships with a spouse or a partner. They live with their wives and children. Many of them hold a full-time job, have lots of friends. But about 25 to 30% of all serial killers actually murder in teams. They kill with a partner, with a cousin, a good friend, a lover. They kill together because there's some kind of chemistry that they don't have when they're alone.
America experienced multiple waves of serial killing. The first wave occurred prior to World War II. That wave included the likes of H.H. Holmes and his murder castle, constructed during the World's Fair in Chicago. Albert Fish, who murdered and cannibalized children. The unsolved case of the Axemen of New Orleans. And of course, Jolly Jane Toppin. This first wave happened when America was transitioning from a world nation of farmers and small towns, transitioning to large cities where immigrants from Europe poured into anonymous neighborhoods. Poverty became rampant. People no longer knew their fellow citizens. There was little or no communication between law enforcement jurisdictions. The psychological study of serial killing wasn't even on the map. Serial killers were more like mythological monsters. And except for the bloody benders, the idea that a man and a woman working together could repeatedly murder helpless victims seemed an impossibility. Then came World War II. Serial murder disappeared from the American public scene. However, once the war was over, serial killing emerged as a real psychological and homicidal phenomenon to be studied.
I believe that the actual term serial murder came from a German police officer way back, probably when Hitler was doing his business in Germany, okay? But it kind of morphed and grew, and then the FBI did their interviews. 36 killers they started with as their pool, and then they decided that serial murder, because movies were serial back in the old days, you had to pay a nickel every week to finish it. Three or more people in separate locations with a sexual component and a cooling off period in between. That's been narrowed down to two or more people. Okay, so they've already notched one down. And there is a movement afoot to have serial killers possibly listed with one victim, because it should be qualitative, not quantitative. It shouldn't necessarily deal on how many victims. It's the killer's mindset. It's the killer's behavior at the crime scene and after the crime scene. So if you kill one person and you get arrested and you go to prison, first of all, you were probably going to kill a whole lot more. And second of all, you probably had virtually every descriptor for a serial killer. So they're called by some people would-bes, could-bes, wannabes. So yes, the definition has really blossomed over the years and changed.
After the war, with the addition of television to the media world, serial killers became nationally recognized figures. The public wanted to hear all they could about this bizarre, despicable form of human behavior. The reality that a man and a woman team could team up to serial kill came to light with a couple known as the Lonely Hearts Killers, the first of a sequence of buddy male-female serial killers.
There are these cases where you find two perpetrators working together.
There's a psychiatric term for this that sometimes fits. It's French, folie à deux, the folly of two, the craziness of two. And what I've found is that in some instances, you find this kind of circle the wagons mentality where you have a very influential offender and a very impressionable offender, the latter taken under the tutelage of the former, for example. Often somebody who's very needy, who wants or needs a father figure. And you find these two individuals who view the world from the perspective of their own little bubble, and they seem to have convinced each other that they need to kill, that they want people to suffer, and they feed each other's twisted perception and rationalize the murders.
They, Martha and Raymond, also known as the Lonely Hearts Killers, because they met their unsuspecting victims through Lonely Hearts ads. From 1947 to 1951, the year of their executions, they were a media sensation. Martha Beck died at the age of 31, executed in the electric chair at Sing Sing Prison, the same day as her live-in lover, Raymond Fernandez, 36, who was executed a few hours before her. She said, "What does it matter who is to blame?" She continued, "My story is a love story, but only those tortured with love can understand what I mean. I was pictured as a fat, unfeeling woman. I am not unfeeling, stupid, or moronic. In the history of the world, how many crimes have been attributed to love?" Born on May 6, 1920, in Milton, Florida, Martha had a tragic, difficult childhood. She had an overbearing, domineering mother who ridiculed her because of her looks and weight. She was also mercilessly teased and tormented by classmates. Reportedly, she was also sexually molested by her brother at the age of 10. Always plagued by being overweight, after Martha finished school, she studied nursing, moved to California, where she worked in an army hospital as a nurse. She engaged in sexually promiscuous behavior and eventually became pregnant. She tried to convince the father to marry her, but he refused. Single and pregnant, she returned to Florida. Shortly after her daughter was born, she became pregnant again by a Pensacola bus driver named Alfred Beck. They married quickly and divorced 6 months thereafter, and she gave birth to a son. Unemployed and the single mother of two young children, Beck escaped into a fantasy world, buying romance magazines and novels and watching romantic movies. In 1946, she found employment at the Pensacola Hospital for Children. She placed a Lonely Hearts ad in 1947, which Raymond Fernandez answered. Raymond Martinez Fernandez was born on December 17, 1914, in Hawaii, to Spanish parents. Shortly thereafter, they moved to Connecticut. As an adult, he moved to Spain, married, and had four children, all of whom he abandoned later on in life. After serving in British intelligence during World War II, Fernandez began a life of petty crime. He once claimed black magic gave him irresistible power and charm over women. Eventually, Fernandez moved to New York City and began answering personal ads by lonely women. He would wine and dine them, then steal their money and possessions. Most were too embarrassed to report the crimes. In one case, he traveled with a woman to Spain, where he visited his wife and introduced the two women. His female traveling companion then died under suspicious circumstances. He then took possession of her property with a forged will. It was probably his first murder. In 1947, he answered a personal ad placed by Martha Beck. Fernandez visited Beck and stayed for a short time. A murderous bond was forming. Martha returned to Florida, but not for long. Shortly, Martha packed up and arrived on Fernandez's doorstep in New York City. He enjoyed the way she catered to his every whim, and when he confessed his criminal enterprises, Martha quickly became a willing participant and abandoned her children in Florida. She posed as Fernandez's sister, giving him an air of respectability. They were constantly writing lonely hearts letters with potential candidates they could bilk. Their lonely hearts victims often stayed with them or with her. She was extremely jealous and would go to great lengths to make sure he and his intended never consummated their relationship. When he did have sex with a woman, both were subjected to Martha's violent temper. In 1949, the pair committed the three murders of which they would later be convicted. Janet Fay, 66, became engaged to Fernandez and went to stay at his Long Island apartment. When Beck saw her and Fernandez in bed together, she smashed Fay's head in with a hammer in a murderous rage. And then Fernandez strangled her. Fay's family became suspicious, and Martha and Raymond moved on to new victims. They traveled to Byron Center Road in Wyoming Township, Michigan, a suburb of Grand Rapids, to meet Delphine Downing, a young widow with a 2-year-old daughter. While they stayed with Downing, Downing became agitated, and Fernandez gave her sleeping pills. Enraged by Downing's crying daughter, Beck strangled her, though not killing her. Fernandez thought Downing would become suspicious if she saw her bruised daughter, so he shot the unconscious woman. Raymond and Martha stayed for several days in Downing's house. Again, enraged by the daughter's crying, Martha drowned her in a basin of water. They buried the bodies in the basement. But suspicious neighbors reported their disappearance, and police arrived at their door on February 28, 1949. Their story was a media sensation, and eventually Michigan, which had no death penalty, waived their murder convictions, and they were sent to New York, where they could be tried and executed. Two of the worst buddy serial killers were Gerald and Charlene Gallego. From their pictures, they look like the perfect young couple, a perfect young couple who became known as the Love Slave Killers. Born in 1946 in Sacramento, California, Gerald Armand Gallego was bad from birth, and by the time he was 6, he already had a list of sex offenses. Born in the same city, Charlene Adele Williams was a product of a solid, caring home and had an IQ of 160. A 2-time divorcee, she met Gerald, a 7-time divorcee, at a poker club in Sacramento. The two of them hit it off immediately and started their infamous sex-driven murderous relationship. Motivated by depraved sexual fantasies, Gerald and Charlene were a husband and wife serial killer team, active from 1978 until 1980 in the western United States. Gerald dominated Charlene, told her what to wear, how to act, and forced her to turn over any money she made. She still found him exciting, even more when he talked about his fantasy to have what he called young, disposable sex slaves. The fantasy became a nightmare for 17-year-old Rhonda Scheffler and 16-year-old Kippy Vaught in 1978. Using their Dodge van, Gerald and Charlene drove to a shopping center where Charlene was charged with finding their slaves. She lured the girls into the van with promises of smoking pot. When they got there, all the teenagers found was Gerald and his pistol. After forcing the girls into the van, they drove to the Sierra Nevada mountains, where Gerald raped the girls. They were killed at different locations later that day. This scenario was played out again and again over the next few years. Charlene eventually began to involve herself with the rape of the girls that were abducted. In all, they killed at least 9 women, some as young as 13, with one being pregnant. They also killed one man, a boyfriend of a young girl they abducted. Craig Miller and Mary Elizabeth Sowers were their last victims. Craig was gunned down on the side of the road in 1980, and his girlfriend was abducted. This time, however, friends of the couple gave the license plate number of the vehicle to the police, which led to Gerald and Charlene's arrest. In 1984, Charlene testified against Gerald in exchange for not being tried in California. She pled guilty to murder and received a sentence of just over 16 years. Gerald was tried and convicted of murder in both California and Nevada. He was sentenced to death, but died in prison. Not all buddy male-female serial killers are motivated by perversion and sex, as was the case of Faye Copeland and her husband, Ray. Not much is known about Faye. It is reported she had 6 children and knew quite well about her husband's life of crime and psychopathic behavior. But then crime turned to killing for Faye and her husband. Convicted of killing 5 drifters and likely many more, Faye Della Wilson Copeland and Ray Copeland became, at the ages of 69 and 76 respectively, the oldest couple ever sentenced to death in the United States. The M.O. in these crimes varied little. Faye Copeland would invite transient, homeless, or migrant workers to their place, or they were promised an easy and lucrative job. Since the 1970s, the Copelands had been known to pick up hitchhikers to work on his farm. Uneasy neighbors watched year after year as a parade of the scrappy, unsavory, and unshaven came and went. No one ever knew what became of them, and no one cared. They weren't the kinds of characters who were likely to send postcards. It wasn't until late summer 1989, after the anonymous call to the Crime Stoppers hotline, that the residents of Mooresville had their worst suspicions confirmed. The victims had been shot with a .22 caliber rifle, the bodies disposed of on the farm, Ray even using neighboring farms to hide some of the bodies. Buddy serial killers share similar backgrounds and often begin their killing spree when they are young adults. Not so for Ray and Faye Copeland. Their lust for killing came in their retirement years. Why this elderly couple went from being loving grandparents to serial killers who use their victims' clothing to make a warm winter quilt to snuggle under, is both gruesome and disconcerting. The motives for the serial murders were apparently monetary. It was estimated that the Copelands received approximately $32,000 from reselling items from their victims. Like many serial killers, when arrested, Faye denied any knowledge of or involvement in the monstrous acts of murder. She told investigators, "I never done nothing." However, a jury refused to believe her, and Faye Copeland died in prison on December 30th, 2003. Another deadly male-female serial killer duo terrorized the citizens of California. Carol Bundy, a nurse and divorced mother of 2, found her killing mate in Doug Clark, a boiler engineer for the Jergens Lotion Company. Together, they teamed up as Hollywood's Sunset Strip Killers. As crazed a duo of serial killers that ever stalked the streets of America's cities. Starting in the spring of 1980, Bundy and Clark went on a murderous rampage through the City of Angels. A rampage that would leave six dead. The first victims were discovered in June. Two women, both killed with the same signature. A gunshot to the head. A gun purchased by Carol Bundy. This was followed by the tragic murder of Exie Wilson. Her head, chopped from her body, was discovered days later in an ornate wooden box. Quickly, the bodies began to stack up, each killed by a bullet to the head. Five women in all, prostitutes and teenage runaways, women from the fringes of society. The easiest victims.
I think that the subject of the victims of these serial murders is probably something that is criminally under-discussed. These are living, breathing human people whose lives were stolen from them by these individuals. I think the fact that a lot of the victims of serial murderers were people from the fringes of society had a lot to do with not only their availability to the killer, but also to the lack of quick and decisive public response to their crimes. When prostitutes start to disappear from the street, prostitutes disappear all the time. You know, they come and go. It's a transitory thing. Bums, hobos, you know, the old-fashioned term, transients, homeless people, are easy targets for people who desire to commit these kinds of crimes, and the access to them is greater, the ability to get control of them is greater, and over time, depending on the killer's own pathology, the notion of them being missing is significantly lessened. You look at serial killers who did not kill prostitutes or people on the fringes of society. Those cases got a lot of attention, and very quickly.
The case was finally solved when police nabbed Carol Bundy for the murder of Jack Murray, a one-time lover who she shot, stabbed, and beheaded in the back of his van. Confronted with the evidence of her guilt, Bundy implicated her partner, Clark. And Clark returned the favor. The lovers turned on each other like the animals they were.
I interviewed Carol Ann Bundy, Douglas Clark and Carol Ann Bundy, and Bundy was over here in Chowchilla Prison. And I happened to be over there visiting somebody else, and I saw her. Well, one of my colleagues saw her and said, "Hey, you want to go see her?" Okay, so we slipped in and went over to visit her. And it was such an interesting little interview with her. You know, you think she's a serial killer, she must be really dangerous. She looked like just a little lady that couldn't harm a flea. Because she was not well, and she eventually died. She was diabetic and died. But that interview was, I asked her about, because this is Carol Ann Bundy had actually, to prove her loyalty to Douglas Clark, had actually killed her boyfriend, cut off his head, cut off his buttocks, to show her love, that she could do this for him. And you don't understand what Douglas Clark did. They would abduct women off the streets, and then they would cut off their heads, and then they would shampoo their hair and freeze the heads and put makeup on them and so on, and he'd have sex with the heads in the shower. So when I asked her about Douglas Clark, I said, "So did you ever keep in touch with Douglas?" And she goes, "Oh, no, I'm not allowed to talk to him anymore." She says, "Doctor, don't you think that Douglas Clark is a very strange man?" Well, she's asking me this. I want to do a Jeff Foxworthy. Well, not only is he a strange man, but you're a strange woman. What you did was, even though you were his accomplice, I mean, you actually were part of all that. And she didn't kind of grasp that, but she was a follower. And in these dual relationships, when you have two people killing, one always dominates. There's always a leader.
10 years after the Sunset Strip killers perpetrated their evil deeds, Canada's buddy kinky sex killers, Paul Bernardo and Carla Homolka, started their vicious killing spree. Paul Bernardo was born on August 27, 1964. He was described as an adorable baby with bright blue eyes, thick, wavy blonde hair, and a cherubic smile. He was a Boy Scout and a good student. However, he ran away at the age of 5 or 6 and returned home several days later. No one ever asked him where he had been. He did not socialize with other children and was subject to violent temper tantrums. After high school, he attended the Scarborough branch of the University of Toronto. Carla Leanne Homolka was born on May 4, 1970. Her father was a Czech immigrant and salesman. Her mother worked at St. Catherine's Shaver Hospital. Though she had a consistently acrimonious relationship with her parents, she had an enjoyable childhood. She made friends easily and was a very good student. She did, however, have the disconcerting habit of yelling, "fuck," at inappropriate times. And during her teen years, angst led to self-mutilation. She intentionally slit her wrist with a small knife a couple of times. Bernardo and Homolka, just a couple of young Canadians ready to join paths in serial killing. It began when, at age 17, Homolka attended a pet convention in Toronto, where she met 23-year-old Paul Bernardo. They had sex the day they met. Besides an interest in pets, they found they shared something else: sadomasochistic fantasies. It started with rape, but quickly led to murder. Murders that took place between December 23, 1990 and April 16, 1992.
The crimes of Paul Bernardo and Carla Homolka were among the most disgusting of the serial killer cases. Paul Bernardo, before his serial murder career began, was known as a Scarborough rapist. He raped approximately 350 women over a series of years. When he and Carla got together, he was a macho man, and Carla was kind of unconfident. So for Christmas one year, Carla gave Paul her sister as a sex toy. They took her downstairs to the basement, and they gave her food laced with halcyon, and then they put a cloth saturated with ether over her face. Before Paul could rape her, though, she choked on her own vomit. And I think that level of deplorability is not common in all serial murder cases. Another thing they did that was especially terrible is when they caught a woman, they would kidnap her, take her home, rape her and torture her, and then make her watch TV coverage of the crimes. And I consider that to be a psychological, sadistic act that is not often found in serial murder cases. They turned on each other after the event, and Carla pled to a lesser crime, and her career testimony put Paul away. But I think when you look at all the things they did, they were just horrible, horrible people and unusually vicious serial killers.
Like other buddy serial killing teams, one is usually dominant.
It's believed that Paul was the leader, that he attracted Carla, Carla wanted him, and would do anything to get him. As in many cases, the exact victimage is unknown. The best guess is 4 or 5 victims.
On June 29, 1991, just 14 days after murdering Leslie Mahaffey, Bernardo and Homolka were married in an elaborate wedding at a church in Niagara-on-the-Lake, Ontario. The guests were served a lavish sit-down meal after the couple exchanged their vows, vows which included, at Bernardo's insistence, Homolka promising to love, honor, and obey her new husband, They looked like the perfect, loving couple. But they were anything but. Eventually, the Canadian media and public played a role in this deadly couple's capture.
Many a times, if there aren't leads in a case, publicity will bring in enough tips that someone can be caught. That happened in the case of Paul Bernardo and Carla Homolka, who were escaping with their crimes until the police broadcast a TV show about this, and then a couple of witnesses realized what they knew, and the salience of their information to the crimes, and they called in.
Recognizing the writing was on the wall, Homolka confessed to their evil deeds. Bernardo was arrested shortly after. When law enforcement searched Bernardo's home, they found a diary where he had memorialized his evil deeds. Having struck a plea deal in 1993, Carla Homolka was released from prison 12 years later on July 4, 2005. Paul Bernardo is serving a life sentence. Many claim their punishments were not nearly enough for the crimes carried out by this deadly couple. Born December 6, 1957, in Southern California, Dana Sue Gray's motive for killing was one of the most bizarre in the annals of serial murder. During her interrogation by police, she remarked that, "I felt this overwhelming need to shop." This was coupled with the fact that Gray didn't merely kill her victims, she aggressively assaulted them. One victim was nearly decapitated and stabbed 11 times with a knife left in her body. She also strangled another with tremendous physical force.
When I do talks on serial murder, and if there's a large female population, I mention her because women respond to it so well. She had a tough childhood. Her mom was a beauty queen, and they didn't get along. And then her dad divorced her mom and got a stepwife who didn't care for Dana Sue. And she was involved in all the kind of things people got involved with at that time. She smoked some pot, and she had a couple of boyfriends that she moved in with at 14 and 15 and 16. What's interesting is the three women she killed, and there may be another victim too, they were residents of gated communities. They were retirement centers. And the crimes were just brutal. The law enforcement officers and the coroners who went to the crime scene said it was the most brutal crime scene they'd ever seen. The victims were first bludgeoned and then stabbed and in some cases strangled. And the police said the amount of blood present at the scene was difficult to believe that one person did all that. When she was caught, she initially denied the offense, the charges, and then quickly when the receipts were shown to her and when the videos from the stores were shown to her, she capitulated and had to admit that she stole all the things. And there's two really famous quotes about her, things that she said. One of them was, "I had this terrible depression, and when I shopped, it would go away." And the other one was that she lived to shop. Shopping was her whole life. And she didn't have the money to do it, so she obtained that money any way that she could.
And one of those ways was?
Was murder. She murdered people for money.
Starting around 1994, in and around Riverside, California, it is believed that Gray killed between 3 and 6 women. She pled guilty to 2 murders and 1 attempted murder, and was suspected of 3 additional homicides. A psychiatrist contended that Gray most likely had also killed patients. In addition to the shopping motive, a second psychiatrist who examined Gray concluded she had a trio of psychological triggers: the desire to shop, the need to have power over and dominate others, and unresolved family issues. This therapist suggested that the victim somehow nauseated Gray, reminded her of her mother, or had behaved in a condescending or demeaning manner toward her. In short, she loved the sense of power killing people gave her. Gray was as much a monster as any male serial killer. One of the strangest of the female serial killers was a kindly grandmother, an elderly woman who looked more at home baking cookies than murdering for money. Her life was a never-ending series of strange happenings and run-ins with the law. The Grandma Serial Killer was born in 1929 in Redlands, California. Her home life was abusive, and after both parents died within a year of each other, she went to live in an orphanage. Married in 1945 by the age of 16, her husband mysteriously disappeared. Soon after, she spent 6 months in jail for forging checks. In 1952, she entered into a 14-year violent marriage. During that time, she owned a brothel and was arrested for vagrancy. Eventually, she picked up a trade as a nurse's aide, caring for disabled and elderly people. She remarried Roberto Puente, and after he disappeared, she took over a 16-bedroom care home for the homeless and destitute. At the age of 53, she started renting an upstairs apartment in another home, and people started dying. By now, she looked innocent enough, a kindly grandmother figure who created a house of murder. She was Dorothea Puente.
Dorothea Puente was a very interesting case because people, you know, you don't want to suspect that the nice lady next door is a serial killer. You don't think of her that way. And she's such a nice person, and so often that people get duped by that.
Every month, Puente collected all the tenants' mail before they saw it and gave them only a small amount of their money. Invariably, the tenants squandered what little money they had at the nearest bar and were picked up by the police and jailed for 30 days following anonymous tips. Puente then pocketed the rest of the tenants' money.
Dorothy Puente in California was a woman who she took care of disabled people, and then she would poison them and then bury them in the backyard. I think she killed 8 victims, and she would collect their Social Security checks and cash them. And she was very good at it.
On November 11th, 1988, police found a body buried in the lawn of 60-year-old Dorothea Puente's home. 7 bodies were eventually found. Puente was charged with a total of 9 murders, convicted of 3, and sentenced to 2 life sentences. No one knows exactly how many victims were claimed during Puente's serial murder career. One source claimed that although Puente was charged with 9 murders, police considered her to be a solid suspect in 12 homicidal deaths. Another estimate claimed that the true number of victims ranged between 9 and as many as 25. The police department estimated that between 1986 and 1988, approximately 25 of her tenants vanished without a trace. Some women serial killers, like their male counterparts, murder for pleasure and power. Such was the case of Aileen Wuornos. She was the first recognized solo female serial killer who killed in as violent and abusive a manner as any man.
Women are just a strange breed of killer. Many women serial killers are either healthcare professionals, okay, nurses that kill patients, or they are black widows that kill husbands and multiple husbands for insurance money, etc. Serial killer women are rare breed. One of them that stands out is Aileen Wuornos. She killed all of her Johns, people that tried to pick her up and then sexually assault her, as she said. She shot them, killed them all outside, generally speaking. So there's no signature with her. So like I said, many serial killers, males, have a signature. The women, I'm not sure I'd go there.
Once again, here was a serial killer who broke psychologists and law enforcement's common understanding as to what a killer was. This time, it was a gay woman prostitute who killed straight men in 1989 and 1990. The 2003 Hollywood blockbuster film, Monster, starring Charlize Theron as Aileen Wuornos and Christina Ricci as her lesbian lover, romanticizes Wuornos' plight, making her into an anti-hero. Perhaps Aileen's first murder was self-defense. But the next six murders were calculated, cold-blooded killings. Men shot multiple times, their bodies dumped along Florida's highways. Warnos declared, "I killed those men, robbed them as cold as ice, and I'd do it again, too. I'm competent, sane, and I'm trying to tell the truth. I'm one who seriously hates human life and would kill again." She was born in Rochester, Minnesota on February 28, 1956. Aileen had a rough early life. Her parents separated before she was born. 4 years later, she was abandoned by her mother and adopted by Lori and Britta Warnos. Despite her traumatic childhood, Aileen showed a talent for singing and dancing, and she expressed interest in becoming a movie star. Childhood photographs show Warnos was a beautiful, blonde-haired, freckled little girl with a beaming smile. But life took a dark turn when she became pregnant at 14 after being raped. As a young adult, she was uneducated and lacked skills or any kind of job training. The only job she ever had was turning tricks. She frequently stole from the men she serviced. Her prostitution career lasted more than 20 years. After an unsuccessful heterosexual relationship, Warnos embarked on a lesbian lifestyle. In June 1986, Aileen met Tyria Ty Moore. Now living in Florida, they spent 4 years together and may have partnered in some of the killings. When Warnos started killing at the age of 33, her M.O. seemed opportunistic in nature. All of the victims were shot with a small caliber revolver at close range. They were all found in remote dump sites near major highways. Some victims were found naked, while others were clothed. Warnos may have lured the men to their death with the promise of a sexual encounter, or they may have picked her up hitchhiking. She probably lashed out against her victims in anger. Her known victims include Eugene or Troy Burris, Richard Mallory, Walter or Gino Antonio, Charles or Richard Humphreys, Peter Seams, Charles Carskaden, and David Spears. The end to her murderous killing spree was near when, on July 4, 1990, Moore and Warnos were seen abandoning Spears' car. In addition, Warnos's palm print was found on the interior door handle. Police sketches of the suspects were released on November 30, 1990. The sketch depicted a stocky woman wearing a hat and a younger, slimmer woman with tattoos. Warnos was named a suspect several weeks prior to her arrest, and she was put under surveillance. Aileen Warnos was arrested at the Last Resort Bar. Moore was located at the home of her family in Pennsylvania, and she agreed to cooperate with law enforcement in the case against Warnos. Eventually, Warnos confessed to some of the murders and was executed in 2002. However, when the public thinks of female serial killers, they most often think of angels of mercy, women in care facilities who put suffering patients out of their misery. This is largely a myth. They do their killing for the same reason other serial killers do. Janine Jones was bestowed with the moniker the Death Nurse. She exemplifies a genre of serial murderers ironically called the Angels of Mercy. This Angel of Mercy killed over 60 infants and children in her care. Maybe even more, because hospital officials allegedly misplaced and then destroyed records of Jones' activities to prevent further litigation. Janine Jones was born on July 13, 1950, in San Antonio, Texas. She was immediately given up for adoption by her birth parents. Shortly after that, she was adopted by Dick and Gladys Jones. He was a proprietor of a nightclub known as the Kit Kat Club, which was infamous for an illegal gambling operation in the back room. Both of her parents were licensed pilots and thrill enthusiasts. Leading an apparent normal life with a husband and children, Jones began a killing spree around the age of 28. From April 1981 to June 1982, Jones worked as a licensed vocational nurse in the pediatric intensive care unit at Bexar County Hospital in San Antonio, Texas. In this short span of time, 47 babies died in the ICU. 34 of them directly under Jones' care. This epidemic of mysterious deaths attracted attention, leading her colleagues to call her shift the death shift. Her child killing came to an end in 1982 when Chelsea McLennan, just over a year old, arrived at the local clinic for routine immunization shots. Instead of administering the vaccine, Jeanine Jones injected her three times with a muscle relaxant that stopped her heart. This death launched a criminal investigation, and with multiple damning testimonies regarding the string of mysteriously dead patients under Jones' care, she was convicted and sentenced to 99 years in prison for McLennan's murder. Jones, like other angels of mercy, enjoyed the power of life and death. It was claimed she enjoyed feeling a sense of importance. Known as the Angel of Death, Kirsten Gilbert was convicted of four murders and two attempted murders of patients admitted to the Veterans Affairs Medical Center in Massachusetts. Gilbert was born on November 13, 1967. In Fall River, Massachusetts. As a teenager, she exhibited psychopathic behavior, constantly lying, manipulating people, faking suicides, violently threatening people. However, by 1988, at the age of 21, she was a registered nurse. As a nurse, she would inject patients with massive doses of epinephrine, an untraceable heart stimulant. This would cause cardiac arrest. And she would respond to the coded emergency herself. During her career at multiple hospitals, she was probably responsible for over 80 unnecessary deaths and 300 medical emergencies. She loved wielding the power over life and death.
Hospitals are in this bind of they can't warn, you know, future employers, because if they don't have if they have proof, then they need to turn that over to the police. But if they do that, now the reputation of the hospital is at stake, and they want to not do that. It's hard to get proof because sometimes patients are cremated or they're buried, or whatever medication was used will dissipate quickly. So it's hard to get proof, and you have to exhume people, which is very expensive. So they might involve police, might not, but they are not allowed to warn future employers. So what they do is say, we want you to leave, we will give you recommendations. This is the way it is all over the country, and even in some other countries, until laws change and allow people to say what their suspicions are, you're gonna have, you know, dangerous situations.
Gilbert's murdering career was put to an end in 1998. She is serving a life sentence at a federal penitentiary. Just as ethnic minorities and homosexual men joined the recognized ranks of serial killers, so did women. Perhaps their number of victims even exceed that of men.
We've certainly had females who are more aggressive than some male serial killers. There isn't a way to say there's a female type of serial killer, because some kill for gain. Quite often they kill for gain. They kill their husbands, for insurance, or whatever the husband has. They might kill their children because the children are a burden, or they're looking for attention, or they have a mental illness. Quite often you're going to find something like Munchausen syndrome by proxy in that group, or borderline personality disorder, something like that. But we still do have predatory females who are looking for personal gain. They don't tend to kill for reasons of lust, but some have. I've actually seen statements where there's no such thing as a female lust murderer, and that's just not true.
There was the case of Gail Graham and Catherine May Wood.
There were two who worked together in an elder care facility in Michigan, and they would together kill patients and then as part of their sex games, and then wash down the bodies and have sex in a vacant room.
The two women met at the Alpine Manor nursing home shortly after Graham had moved to Michigan from Texas. They quickly became friends, and then lovers, in 1986. 2 years later, they both were facing murder charges for allegedly smothering five elderly patients as part of a love bond. Wood claimed Graham murdered the patient to relieve her tension. Wood was described as the psychopathic manipulator, and Graham as a susceptible woman with a personality disorder. Graham is serving a life sentence, and Wood was given early release from prison. So not only are women part of the expanded profile of the serial killer, but also gay women. There's some speculation that the number of female serial killers has been increasing in the 21st century. An interesting case in point is Betty Newmar, the Black Widow granny, who, at the age of 77, killed her last victim, John Newmar, in 2007.
Betty Newmar is a really interesting person. Her first murder, it's believed, was in 1950, the last in the 2000s. So she was a black widow. Her victimology was her husband's, and they all died the same way, of a close-range gunshot when nobody else was in the room. One husband was killed on a pier in New York City. Newmar is believed these crimes were for profit. He's trying to benefit financially from them. And as is the case often in these kind of crimes, it was her greed that got her convicted, although she never was convicted of serial murder. And the reason is she was arrested and charged with hiring two men to kill her husband, one an ex-cop and one a neighbor. Well, when the trial was set, the DA office had a discussion, disagreement about the case. Some prosecutors thought they couldn't get a conviction, others thought they could, so the case was dropped. So she may be one of the more successful serial killers in history if she did kill four or five people, but the charges were dropped and she never went to trial.
Once again proving the point that women serial killers are active much longer than their male counterparts. On June 13th, 2011, Betty Newmar died in a Louisiana hospital of an undisclosed illness. In conclusion, studies and statistics show that nearly 20% of all serial murderers are women. Compared to men, a higher percentage of homicides committed by women are done by serial killing women. Compared to men, women serial killers are more likely to be familiar with their victims. For example, patients in their care versus prostitutes. Women are equally as likely to murder women and children as adult males. And, as a buddy serial killing couple, women are just as likely to be psychopathic sadists as their male counterparts.